Good evening, it's 6:30. Federal hearings on the crash that caused the collapse of the Eggner's Ferry Bridge have concluded in Paducah. We get the latest tonight on Front Page PM from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe. This is Front Page PM, our Friday evening news magazine, bringing you the stories, events, and issues of our Four Rivers region. We also bring you Front Page AM Friday mornings at 8:35 and the hour-long Front Page Sunday at 9 a.m. We stay true to our name as we focus on two issues affecting our area rivers. And later in the program, we hear from the executive director of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, Daniel Seen, and maestro Raffaele Ponte about the conclusion of this year's season and what's ahead for the PSO. But first, a Coast Guard fact-finding hearing on the ship crash that collapsed a portion of the Eggner's Ferry Bridge wrapped up today. Throughout the week, we've heard from state highway officials, Coast Guard officials, employees of Foss Maritime, which own and operate the Delta Mariner, and the ship's pilot. Casey Northcutt has been covering these hearings for WKMS. She joins me to talk about the testimony today and the overall outcomes of the week-long hearing. Casey, let's first talk about testimony from pilot Michael Collins. First, explain the terms of his employment with Foss.
Michael Collins is an independent river pilot contracted by the Foss Maritime Company as a pilot advisor. He is not a Foss Maritime employee, and he merely advises the crew how to navigate. He was not at the helm during the accident, but he was giving directions. Strangely enough, Foss does not have a written contract with Collins. Foss Senior Vice President of Operations Scott Merritt told me that it's common practice for river pilots not to have written contracts. They have been assisting ships up and down the river system since before Mark Twain's time.
So what is pilot Collins' background then?
Collins has 36 years of maritime experience and several licenses, including certificates from the Seamen's Church Institute. He has piloted the Delta Mariner through the Eggner's Ferry Bridge 5 times.
Yesterday, the captain of the ship said he made a suggestion just a few minutes before impact that if the boat needed to turn around or stop, that, quote, now would be the time to avoid impact with the bridge. Pilot Collins didn't take his advice. Why not?
Collins believed it was already too late to turn around.
Does Pilot Collins assume blame for the accident?
No, he does not. He said a couple of times that he believed that the lights fooled him, or he was fooled by the lights.
And did they get into the details associated why he wasn't aware of the lighting issues that were on the bridge?
He understood that the bridge did not have proper lighting. He knew that there were supposed to be 3 white lights on the main span. As far as everyone has testified, and no one who gave testimony during the investigation knew about the notice to mariners that said that the lights were out on the Eggner's Ferry Bridge. Somehow they missed that. So what Pilot Collins understood was that there weren't lights on the main span for some reason, and he thought that he was steering the boat into the channel adjacent to the main span, which he says that river pilots transit all the time, and they do it safely. And so he also said that he could transit a boat through an unlit span, but it was easier to transit through a lit span. So that's what he was aiming for.
Did Pilot Collins commit any egregious errors, according to the Coast Guard?
To some extent, that's a matter of opinion. Officials asked a lot of questions about why Collins didn't use certain pieces of equipment and navigational guides, like sailing lines, for instance. And he replied that the sailing line wasn't always accurate and that he didn't check other navigational tools because he believed he knew which span he was transiting until too late. So they asked pointed questions. It really depends on your point of view, honestly.
So what's next then, now that these hearings are over?
The investigative body will take this information and go through evidence and testimony for the next several months before they file a report on the causes.
And then have you talked to any legal counsel or representatives from Foss or the Highway Department to see how this may affect any further legal action related to the crash?
Representatives were vague on legal actions that will be taken, but Sonny Smith, an attorney for the Transportation Cabinet, said the findings and the report from this hearing will not be admissible in court.
Casey, you had a chance to catch up with Scott Merritt, a VP with Foss Maritime. Did you find out anything about the future employment of any of these mariners that were on the ship the night that it crashed?
A couple of the crew members who were called to testify in this investigation have by choice left Voss Maritime Company. Everyone else is still employed.
Did he mention anything about contracting with Pilot Collins again?
He said that was not up to him.
Okay, Casey Northcutt, thanks very much for your time covering these hearings this week.
Thank you.
Construction on the Olmsted Lock and Dam project in southern Illinois has been ongoing for 20 years, 13 years over schedule. Now a completion date is set for 2026. Shelley Baskin spoke with project engineer Richard Shipp on the problems plaguing the project and what lies ahead for the site.
The Olmsted Dam project has been experiencing a lot of cost overruns and delays since its construction started, and I understand that they're starting a review process for it. What all will be a part of this review process?
The Corps is looking at all options, to be quite honest. We're looking at construction methods, and as some of you may know, we're building the dam in what we call an in-the-wet methodology. In lieu of the coffer dams, we are revisiting that decision and looking at whether it's possible to go back to an in-the-dry method, if that would be cheaper or faster. So that's currently under review. We're looking at contracting techniques, the acquisition strategies for these contracts. Generally, the Corps works in a firm fixed price contracting arrangement. Well, due to the risk on the dam and the nature of the river in this area, we did not get any bidders when we went out on the firm fixed price and had to go cost reimbursable. We're looking at our management approach. We have sent people to other large projects to look at how they're managing the projects. Are they doing anything different than we're doing so we can bring those lessons back? We brought in independent consultants from outside the government to look at a lot of these things and make sure that we're meeting our requirements and our regulations and if there's anything they have to offer. So basically, we're looking at all options.
And major construction projects are going to have a lot of cost overruns and delays, but this one seems to have more than most. What exactly has been the cause of this project's problems?
Well, there's a multitude of reasons behind it. Certainly, the river in this area is very dynamic. It fluctuates annually somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 45 feet. And anytime you work in the river in those conditions, it's a challenge. And that would be whether you build this with, say, in the wet technology or with a coffer dam or whatever. We had extreme challenges when we built the coffer dam for the lock. So the river is one factor. One of the other major factors is funding. We do not get funding to build the project as efficiently as we would like to be able to build it. We do not buy all the materials we want to buy at one time because we're getting funded on a monthly basis. So you look at how much money you've got left over to apply and how much you're getting next month to go out and buy more equipment, more materials, and that sort of thing. So that's had a major impact on the project. And I think we're recognizing also that the in-the-wet methodology is certainly more costly than what we thought when we made those decisions years ago.
What's the most recent estimate for how much this is going to cost taxpayers?
Well, when we say dam, we need to make sure we understand the terminology. We report the cost for the total project. That includes all previous completed projects plus the dam plus the future projects of removing 52 and 53 and some operational facilities and some equipment. So right now we're projecting a total cost for the entire project of $2.9 billion.
So once all is said and done on this project and it opens up for use, will the cost of the project be worth the rewards from it?
This project provides a significant benefit to this nation. The annual benefits are estimated at $741 million per year, and that's a combination of increased traffic flow, reduced locking times, reduced maintenance, fewer delays and outages. And all in all, that's a savings that the American public will see in their transportation cost. At $741 million a year, in 4 years, the project still pays for itself.
Richard, I appreciate your time, and I thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Richard Shipp is the project engineer of the Olmsted Lock and Dam Project. When we come back, an in-depth conversation with the two men behind the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, Raffaele Ponti and Daniel Seen. They talk about the most recent season of the PSO and what's ahead next year. This is Front Page PM from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page PM from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe. It's been about 8 months since the Paducah Symphony Orchestra has been under the watch of the new executive director, Daniel Seen. Not too long before Seen's arrival came artistic director and conductor Maestro Raffaele Ponti. They're rounding out their first season together. They're here in the studio to talk about the PSO and their history and the future of the orchestra. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Hi, Chad.
Many believe that you two had worked together before coming to the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, but I've found out now that that's not the case.
No, that's not the case. Daniel's been a nice addition this season, being his first season here with the PSO, and it's been a wonderful collaboration.
Yeah, I think our chemistry, maybe that's what led people to believe that we seem to be working well right from the start. So it's been good so far.
So we interviewed both of you not too long after you agreed to work with the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, and your agendas were really quite similar, even though neither of you had talked. Both of you had mentioned the common word was growth. Now, Maestro Ponti, what was your vision for the PSO when you started 2 years ago?
My vision with the PSO remains the same, and it's the same with any orchestra that I work with. It's simply to raise the artistic level of the orchestra, and everything else cascades from that. Audience growth, development, programming, programs, and I certainly feel that we began that 2 seasons ago, my first year, but it has excelled itself with Daniel's help this year. You mentioned, Chad, quickly about the idea, our comments and ideas are similar. We went through an extensive search when we were looking for an executive director, and when Daniel rose quickly to the top of the pile, his ideas and visions were aligned with what we wanted to do and what I wanted to do with the orchestra. And it's a perfect marriage between what we do together, although we do totally different things. It's a great compliment. He supports the arts and makes it happen. I have these dreams that become reality with his efforts.
And so to be clear, your role is the artistic director, so the things that we see on stage relating to the performance and the design of the performance come from you. And Daniel, you back that up with whatever needs that he may have.
Absolutely. And in fact, his vision extends beyond the concert hall and through many efforts in the community with our music education efforts and some of the community engagement initiatives that he started and really spearheaded and said, this is one of the ways that we are going to be able to connect with our community better is to get out into the community and help them understand and appreciate and realize that there's a great orchestra here.
So, Raffaele, what have you done thus far to advance your vision to grow the artistic value and all of the things that would kind of fall in behind that?
Well, you know, every time a conductor gets up, it's a funny thing because what we do I can't really describe because it's a wordless art and just simply done by gestures. It just becomes so clear to me. You could have the same symphony be performed 10 times with 10 different conductors in the same evening. And it would be the same orchestra playing it differently 10 times. It's just something about that. I have a sound and an idea in my head. And the orchestra, I have to tell you, I am so proud of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra. It is a jewel of an orchestra. And I tell Daniel and everywhere we go about this because we have an all-star personnel. We have players who come from 5 states to play in this orchestra. And the waiting list is becoming quite long. And I'm excited about that because the quality is so good. Because of that, the audience appreciates it. But I can't say enough. You know, I have the ideas, I have these artistic visions, and I'm adamant about them, and I like to throw things on the table. Daniel is the one who makes them come to life. Otherwise, it's just a dream for me.
And Daniel, one of your goals that you mentioned in your interview at WKMS back before you took the job officially, or I know it was on your first day on the job is when we spoke with you, that you wanted to make the PSO more relevant. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think a lot of the – Raffaele and I had spoke prior to my being offered the job and then obviously since then. And that's what really sparked my interest in the needs that he was communicating to me at the time made me realize that I could be a good support in that role. And when I mean relevance, I mean being able to get into the community and showing that we're not just an orchestra that comes here and just plays in the concert hall. That as a conductor, he's here for those 7 weeks, and then in addition to that, here at other times as well. We're keeping him busy in the community, actually at his request. And he finds, if we don't keep him busy enough, he finds other things to keep himself busy while he's here as well. So he goes we make it a priority to make sure he's scheduled to go into schools and work with all age ranges of school children. And, you know, he can tell you a little bit more about how he works with, I think, even kindergartners or first grade, second grade.
I give it to you. I'm spending more time in school now, Chad, than when I was supposed to be. But I really enjoy it. Now, as a father, I have a 12-year-old violin player, and it's changed my whole focus that it's about turning on these kids of the possibilities. And through music, you know, if people were just looking at it like sound and instruments or singing in a choir, a band, or an orchestra, they're missing the picture, because we can teach every skill, every discipline through music, but we can go beyond that. We can teach life skills about how to be your best, how to present yourself, how to prepare, how to have the discipline to study and prepare for your job someday, or just for schoolwork or your day, and to see their eyes just open up the possibilities. And it's all through music.
Now, Daniel, you answer to a board.
Yeah, we have a board of directors of 34, so it's...
It's a lot of bosses.
A lot of personalities to interact with, but you know, they all bring uniqueness to the table. And I've told folks I'm fans of big boards. I'm fans of small boards, as long as people are engaged and working hard at what they're doing. And Raffaele mentioned like our education committee and some of the other committees that we have working. Development committee, which of course a pretty significant one. The one that I probably work with closely is development, more so to raise the funds. And, you know, they're all working very hard to make sure that this orchestra succeeds and continues to thrive beyond its 32-year history now.
Well, how would you say that the PSO board now defines success in the symphony's current state?
Well, first of all, ending the year in the black is always a very a very good indicator. And actually this year, I'm pleased that that's looking like it's going to be a reality for the first time in several years. And, you know, not by any stroke of genius, but just some good alignment of some stars that have happened and some good energy, as Raffaele had talked about. I think long-term success is still in development. We're still working on that, and I think they're trying to develop that in conjunction with Raffaele's time here with the symphony, and obviously he's brought a lot of excitement and energy. We have a very small amount started in an endowment fund that we'd like to start a campaign in earnest, but for now, and our purposes in evaluating things, we're not at a juncture where we want to launch a large campaign just yet. In fact, this year, if anything, we've started is a new underwriting project that really addresses our core structural deficit issues.
What are those deficit issues?
The fact of the matter is that none of our concerts are underwritten sufficiently. That's really what we've discovered this year in particular, or at least, you know, revealed. And so this underwriting project really addresses that. It's saying, instead of raising, you know, $50,000, say, for concert sponsorships throughout a season, we're going to need to raise $120,000. And we can do that not just by going back to the same wells, and yes, those are important folks to revisit, but also expanding that donor pool and working with our private individuals better and communicating our vision and Raffaele's vision for the orchestra and the community, and you know, getting back to that word relevant, making sure people recognize that we're an integral part to the fabric of the community, and not just the community of Paducah, McCracken County, but the entire region. And in fact, we are starting to use the tagline more, we're the region's only professional orchestra, and that's always been true, but no one really understands that between Nashville, Memphis, St. Louis, and now Cincinnati, we're really the region's only professional orchestra. There are some others out there, but they're not quite the same brand as what we're putting out there.
Let's talk about, too, just growing your audience, growing the excitement level within the audience, and that has to do with your choice in music, Raffaele, and How do you go through the process of developing a concert?
Well, I have to think seasonally. I think from September to April, there has to be something on that menu in the season for everyone. And there has to be a balance of things. I mean, you can't do all Mozart all season long. I mean, it's just flat. It's not enough there. And you can't do all Mahler either. So there has to be a seasonal schedule and a plan. So there's a diet that we fill everybody's musical needs. But then there also has to be a musical layout from the beginning of the concert to the end. And I think, like Daniel's mentioned, my philosophy is the music will live forever. The presentation needs to be updated, and the concert experience has to be changed to become more like what our lives are suited for now, or the pace of life. And I think we're doing that. I think from the moment they park their car, you walk into that lobby, there's things happening. There's energy. There's buzz. We're bringing in some great soloists, and that dictates a little bit of the repertoire, which violin choice, which piano concerto are we going to be listening to. But they have to be somebody who can turn you on. It's not just about somebody playing that piano concerto. It's about how they're going to play that piano concerto. Mm-hmm. That's important. I have a real taste of music. I like certain things, and I conduct things certainly better than other things. I'm not a Baroque specialist. I don't think the Carson Center is a Baroque theater, and I don't think we have the orchestra to play Baroque music because of the instruments, you know, the Baroque style bowing and those details. So it would be a mistake to lean in that direction. But I do think we do the Romantic very well into the 20th century, very, very well. And I have just a riot introducing our audiences and orchestras to new repertoire. Mm-hmm. I did a piece of music, it's not new, Howard Hanson's Symphony No. 2 last concert. Nobody knew who it was. There was one person on our board that knew the piece because mm-hmm. he's a Hanson fan. The audience went goo goo gaga over this thing.
What's interesting about that concert is that the last half of the program was Beethoven's Fifth, mm-hmm. you'd think. And that's really the one we marketed heavily about, obviously. But I was amazed after the performance hearing from folks, you know, I came because of Beethoven, but I fell in love with Hanson.
Do you also choose your selections based on your geographic location? And I use the term sell, but would a concert at the Chicago Symphony sell just like it would at the Paducah Symphony, or do you have to design it differently because of your audience in a more rural area?
Yes. I think every orchestra that I guest conduct or conduct has to be different programming. You can't bring the same thing because the orchestras are different. There's different talent strengths, different levels, and then there's a different community. You have to really get a handle on programming. The hardest thing for me to do was to program my first season not knowing the orchestra or the community. Mm-hmm. It was all speculation. You know, you looked at what they've been doing for the last five seasons, so you get a flavor for what the rhythm was, but also you don't want to repeat anything too soon. And I saw certainly some directions and some ideas of another artistic person who had a different idea that I do, but you have to get a read on the public. And I think what it comes down to at this point, and I think Dana would agree, I think the audience will come and hear anything we program at this point because I think they're guaranteed that they're going to receive, no matter what it is, an artistic and a high-quality performance. And I think it comes down to less about what you say but more about how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel, you had mentioned that this year it looks as though the PSO will end in the black, which is good news. Mm-hmm. To what can you attribute ending in a good financial stead at the end of the season?
There's been, you know, a lot of hard work on behalf of the board that has happened towards some fundraising activity that, of course, has added to that. But also, even before really the season started, is that this year, the first year, all seven of our subscription concerts were in the Carson Center. And yes, it added a significant expense, but also when you put all of those, it used to be five concerts in the subscription series, we went to seven. And of course, that gave a boost in season ticket sales. And then when you combine that with some last minute specials that we had leading up to the beginning of the season, and this season in particular, the 11-12 season is the best sold subscription season we've ever had in terms of revenue. and then also I think in terms of seat count as well. And so we're just looking at next year building on that success. We're the people we need to be focusing on most, and that's our season ticket holders, and making sure that they're renewing for next year. And I think Rob Elliott and I announced the season last month when he was here, and there's just a lot of excitement. We're making great strides in reaching our renewal goals. So we're trying to make it more accessible for those who want to come and have great entertainment and a great concert 7 times throughout the year. And so and really the idea is to fill the concert hall and make those the social engagements of the year.
And Maestro initially said you would sign on for a 3-year contract,
right?
And now this is the end of your second season. You're starting your third season. Are there any contract negotiations developing for you to move on past the 3-year contract?
Well, we'll begin negotiations this next year. We'll be in negotiations the entire year, and my agent's very much looking forward to that.
And Daniel Seen, this is your first year at the helm. Are you under any contract obligations?
Yeah, I get to negotiate year after year, which is great for me. But probably Rafael is being a little bit modest about this. I think it's pretty widely known that we'll be moving towards an additional contract with him and some sort of extension there. And we want to keep him here, and the community wants to keep him here. So we're very happy with him.
Well, Daniel Seen, the executive director for the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, and Maestro Raffaele Ponte, the artistic director and conductor of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, both thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chad, thank you, and keep up the great work with playing all that great classical music.
The Paducah Symphony Orchestra wraps up its season tomorrow evening with a night at the opera with the PSO Symphony Chorus, Children's Chorus, and Youth Chorus. Hear the music of Verdi, Puccini, Bizet, Rossini, and Wagner. The concert begins at 7:30 at the Carson Center. This has been Front Page PM, our regional news segment following Marketplace at 6:30 on Fridays. You may have missed Front Page AM today, now a regular feature at 8:35 Friday mornings. If you'd like to hear any of these stories or any of our stories online anytime, go to WKMS.org. You can also catch us Sunday morning at 9 for our hour-long program, Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe. Thanks for being with us.